As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Pim, we were over the weekend setting up the best way to discuss the senator from Arizona. My first name was Stavridis.
Yes, Admiral James George Stavridis.
Well, James Stavridis.
Yeah.
I said, let's get Admiral Stavridis out, of course, at Tufts. And of course, his wonderful book, Sea Power, which talks about our oceans, is well. Admiral, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Your thoughts on John McCain?
Well, let me start. We've been talking correctly about what it means for the nation to lose John McCain. If I may, I want to tell you what it means for the Navy to lose John
McCain. That's exactly what I wanted.
He really is a legend, starting back at the Naval Academy, where he was the ultimate bad boy. He had more demerits than anybody in his class. He graduated at the absolute bottom of his class. He got away with everything, and he was beloved for it. Flash forward, incredible heroism in Vietnam, we all know that. And then consistently for the rest of his life, the Navy continued to be a touchstone. He was the son and grandson of two four-star admirals. And I can tell you, as a four-star admiral myself, that is not an easy position. I look at my own children in the Navy struggling with that. John McCain was an icon for this nation, but even more so for the U.S. Navy. We will miss him deeply.
Who are the new John McCains in the Navy? If you go to Annapolis today, who are the new John McCains? How do you build them today?
We are fortunate that the service academies, and here I'll grudgingly admit the place just up the river called West Point does a pretty good job.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Thank you.
As does the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
I wasn't aware of them either.
All those academies are all about duty, honor, country. They are all driven by honor codes that say we will not lie, cheat, or steal. And they produce people to throw a name out like Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, four-star admiral, as straight as an arrow, an extraordinary leader. There are plenty of John McCains out there these days.
Admiral Stavridis, John McCain was a naval aviator, and that also had an effect on the way people look at appropriations and the power that the U.S. Navy is able to project. I'm wondering if you could just comment on his role as a naval aviator and what legacy he will leave there.
Yeah, I have to begin by saying that I came out of the academy and I wanted to be a naval aviator, you know, like Goose and Maverick and Top Gun. By the way, the remake is coming out soon. And I could never do it because every time I did a barrel roll, I lost my lunch in the cockpit. So I have enormous respect for these aviators. And really, that ability to project power from sea on these massive aircraft carriers, 80 combat aircraft on the decks of each, 7 acres, those sovereign American acres that go anywhere. They can move 1,000 miles in a day. These are extraordinary machines of war, but they are useless without these naval aviators like John McCain.
You commanded the Enterprise Carrier Strike Group, and that conducted operations in the Persian Gulf, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom. What's changed in terms of the use of aircraft carriers to project not just military force, but political influence?
What's really changed since I had command of Enterprise, and we were doing simultaneous operations in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and over the Horn of Africa, that incredible operational flexibility, that ability to maneuver, that has not changed. But what has changed is the rise of peer navies, notably China and Russia, have become much more capable at sea. So instead of, if you will, getting open sea space to move those carriers and simply launch those strikes, today our carriers have to worry about other navies at sea who can compete with us, like China and Russia. That means we have to be better at missile defense, better at anti-submarine warfare, better at protecting the carrier at sea than we had to previously.
Admiral, to finish up with our discussion of John McCain before we get back to more important international relations matters with your work at Tufts Fletcher School, Al Hunt, in his beautiful essay, mentions John Glenn. And I think there's not enough said about, you know, we know of McCain over Vietnam, but the technology of the Korean War that Ted Williams and John Glenn flew in was medieval. Is medieval the right word?
Yes, medieval is the right word. And you're right to mention both of those legends, especially John Glenn, who was a lifelong naval aviator. He was a U.S. Marine Corps, and of course, they're part of the Department of the Navy. And they flew basically flying crates that were very similar to what came out of World War II. By the time John McCain was flying,
yeah,
much more advanced radar, much better capability. You have to tip your hat to people like John Glenn.
When I look at it, what we're talking about here, it is about the deployment, as Pim was mentioning, the boats in the water today. The aircraft
ships.
Carrier, excuse me, ships. So you what I know.
Yeah. Spoken like a real Navy man.
Thank you. Yeah, God, nailed that. Mm-hmm. As far as I got, Admiral Stavridis was a Grumman canoe.
With wings.
Yes, with wings. Within this, Admiral Stavridis is a new technology. Would Senator McCain know the two technology? Could he land a plane on one of these new carriers we have?
In a minute. And I will tell you that actually that technology makes it, Tom, so you could probably land a plane on an aircraft carrier. That's how good it is. No, seriously, John McCain was an intuitive, lifelong learner. And I think that's a very important quality in a leader, that ability to change and step into new technology. And John McCain did that every day. That's why he was so important on the Senate Armed Services Committee, because he knew those technologies so well as he was funding them for us to take them to war.
Well, let's finish up this discussion before we get back to the work at hand. Your wonderful book and my book of the year, The Leader's Bookshelf, had 70, 80, 90 books in it. For our listeners, what is the book in the Leader's Bookshelf that has the most to do with Senator McCain?
I think the one that would reflect the most would be another prisoner of war story, and that's James Stockdale, who you'll recall, Tom, was at one point vice presidential candidate with Ross Perot. He and his wife, Sybil, Stockdale and his wife, Sybil, wrote a book called In Love and War about Stockdale's time in the camps, alternating chapters between the two of them. It's a love story that transcends war and is also brings to focus what John McCain went through in those camps.
Let's come back with James Stavridis, the Tufts. James Stockdale, Pym, buried at the Naval Academy, and Mr. McCain will join him.
Yes, he was, Admiral Stockdale was also, he was shot down in North Vietnam. That was in September, I believe, 1965.
Oh, we'll come back with James Stavridis. Lots to talk about on our international relations film. I liked where you were going there with the boats at hand today. And ships, boats.
Ships. Yeah, well, I got to say also, you know, just over the weekend, there was a report that there were three Russian warships that were spotted passing through the Bosphorus.
Yes.
And that connects Turkey.
Well, let's come back and talk to James Stavridis about that. More typical themes, but we thank him for his comments on Senator McCain. Well, John Golub with us listening to the opening show festivities. And there's sort of that August end, and school used to start Wednesday of Labor Day, and that's sort of when you reallocated your portfolio. And as we all know, anybody with parents, we hate it. It's all starting earlier and earlier. We're there now. How do you reallocate this morning?
First of all, I'm not sure that you really do reallocate, but you and I were talking about this before on TV. The real question is, how much of your money do you put in technology, and how strong are
within
these stocks?
Within your equity investment, where do you put it in tech?
Yeah, and I think right now these companies are just so powerful in their ability to earn and their potential upside, and even as importantly, the damage that they're doing to other large parts of the economy in the process of their success is just making them look relatively so much more attractive.
Relatively attractive, and that goes to the idea of value trap. Where's the value trap in the market? Our listeners, they're going to make decisions, they're in cash, they've missed the bull market. Where are we 12 months trailing? I can bring this up in a Bloomberg quickly with the WEI function. It's only up 18%, double digit, in the last 12 months. Okay, fine. Where's the value trap that I want to buy cheap, but it's a mistake?
Well, I will tell you, when I'm talking to traditional value investors, they're finding it hard to find anything that looks really cheap. But I think that perhaps the area might be in consumer staples companies that were very expensive, have fallen a fair bit, are a little bit cheaper than the market right now, but their brands are just getting demolished by technology. And we are changing the way that we're buying things, because you can, you know, have, you know, just search on Google or Amazon.
I'm going to pick up a major consumer, something you buy at the grocery store all the time, folks. And revenue growth is flat, with the hope and prayer of single-digit growth into the future, versus a major tech company where in 90 days you can get 2 years of revenue growth that you get in a food company.
And I know that you love the idea of cash flows, but if you look at the price per cash flow on these tech companies, they're trading at a discount to the market, partially because investors don't fully believe that this growth can continue into the future. And I think that they're likely going to be wrong.
And part of this is the management of those tech companies. Is it safe to say that they're not making the accounting and capital deployment mistakes of previous tech bull markets? I think there's a little more responsibility out there.
Yeah, maybe that, or it may just be that some of these stories are coming of age. I was mentioning this again on the TV show this morning, but if you look at the revenue chart of Amazon versus Walmart, one of them, you know, which is the Amazon line, just looks like it launches, that it was at one pace for a period of time, and then all of a sudden the revenues and profits, mm-hmm. as we all became more comfortable with these types of brands, and it's not only that one company, but others as well.
How do you buy tech if our listeners say, I don't want to buy just the three names everybody else owns? Do you buy an ETF?
You can buy an ETF. You can buy a broad portfolio. Mind you, there's a whole... There's dozens or hundreds of companies that are part of that ecosystem, and you don't want to buy just five or seven names. There's success stories in everything. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if you even look in areas like REITs, real estate investment trusts, which wouldn't be what you think about technology, but the most exciting companies there are companies that are building data centers for cloud computing, and those are interesting plays. You're seeing that in innovative consumer companies that are using technology. So it's not just a narrow group.
Our David Wilson does a great equity update in the 9 o'clock hour, sort of like the 10 stocks of the day that are moving in that. And I have been really quite taken by the idiosyncrasies of each retail story. Now, retail's got to react to Amazon. We all understand that as well. How do you strategize about retail and the cacophony of the American consumption pattern?
Well, I think you have a couple of stories here. One is that in the near term, these companies are doing surprisingly well, because the American consumer is in great shape, and the unemployment rate is low, wages are beginning to rise, which has other side effects, but the consumer is in super shape, and that's helping a lot. But the question is it masking perhaps the long-term
story. What does your research
story.
People say at Credit Suisse?
And I think that the long-term story is somewhat dire for many of these brick-and-mortar names, but no different than people who have invested in Japan, where it was for 20 or 30 years a downward trend line, but with periods of brilliant jumps where you wanted to play the game. Right now, maybe one of those times where retail, even though it's on a downtrend, looks absolutely brilliant because the consumer's in great shape.
What about mid-cap, small-cap?
I think that large-cap companies are probably going to continue to do to outpace.
Why?
They're in a world where, again, the economy is good right now, but in a world where the economy has been tighter, where managing margins has been the key to success, larger companies have just done a better job at managing those expenses and margins.
John Golub with us, Credit Suisse, as we look at the equity markets. You know, in an August afternoon, we had Admiral Stavridis on and wonderful comments on John McCain and talking about international relations. On this day, as we did with John Golub of Credit Suisse, a little different conversation. And we could do that with Fred Lane, with Lane Generational, which is a dead serious effort with Raymond James to actually talk to people about the emotion of money. Now, granted, you know, Fred Lane, what's your minimum investment? $200 million?
No, 500,000.
500,000, which is a reasonable number. And to a lot of people, that's a pot, and other people, it's a rounding error. But the answer is, and I don't want to say, what's a Dow going to do? Should I be in the market? I want to talk about how the sweat is different now from the kids than it was 20 or 40 years ago. You've got to deal with the emotion of families. The generational, and how are the kids different than they were a generation ago?
Well, I don't think the kids are so different. I think we as parents, in some cases, have been overly concerned with our kids' emotional well-being and maybe haven't asked them to do enough chores and be self-sufficient enough. I'm saying this about my own children as well. But I think in general, my concern is that the next generation will find it a little harder to accumulate capital than this past generation has found it. The baby boomers have found it easier because there were so many of us entering the economy that drove GDP growth. And I think I think today's world's a little different. I think it's going to be harder to accumulate capital. I think global growth is going to be, over time, it's going to be declining, and that's going to make it harder to accumulate capital.
In the old days, you had a cash flow off of a pot of money, and you could write Ignatz's tuition to whatever school. Today, Pim, correct me if I'm wrong, it's overwhelming. It is, for families and generations, it's just overwhelming. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with somebody with a pot of money who says, look, I can't do this because I can't write the checks. I got to dip into capital.
Well, Pim, do you want to talk?
No, really, excuse me. We're taking notes.
Most of my clients aren't directly in the crosshairs of that dilemma. However, I think the question, and I'm glad it's being asked increasingly, is there a good return on investment in a college education? The rack rate, the rate that's supposed to be paid frequently is not. Okay, so you know, you go average university, maybe it's $70,000, $75,000 all in, but magically they come up with a scholarship for 10,
yeah, but
15.
Your kid could put the puck in under the crossbar from 30 feet out.
Well, he was different. I
mean, yeah, thank you.
Both my kids were different because they were hockey players.
Okay.
And that's rather unfair. They were heavily recruited athletes. And they're put in a different class. But for the average, the really smart, hardworking kid, he's probably not going to get scholarship help if his parents have means.
Oh, really?
And the worst people, the people who are the worst off, I should say, are the people who are making $200,000, $250,000 a year because they're making enough and they've been good savers and they've put money away and they have equity in their home. And the universities don't want to hear about the fact that they need help. And so, you know, frankly, a lot of those kids are going to end up the beneficiary of their parents' largesse. And the parents are going to end up with a lot less in the way of retirement income. And it's an unfortunate situation. That's one of the reasons I say to everybody, all clients, let me meet your children. Let's get the magic of compounding going when they're young, 25, 30 years old. Put away $10,000, $15,000 a year consistently every year. That adds up by the time you're 50. It's a lot of money by the time you're 50.
Fred Lane, I want to ask you about the context in which we kind of do all these comparisons, you know? And one of the things I've kind of noticed is everyone's trying to compare now to a period, let's say, after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that as the anomaly,
right.
Not everyone had any money. I mean, no one had any money. I can remember conversations around the dining room table where when asked about the Depression, my father would say, what Depression? No one had any money before, no one had any money right. during, and no one had any money afterwards.
Right.
And I'm wondering whether we're comparing this to some nostalgic golden age that really didn't exist for most people.
Look, the standard of living for the average from Americans in general is breathtakingly high. There's no question about it. And yet, by comparison, when we see the super wealthy and the very wealthy, all a function of the accumulation of wealth that's gone on, certain people are going to feel as if they've missed out. They've missed because they only have two cars, mm-hmm. and they have a boat, and they don't have a summer home, and oh, too bad. And I'm not saying that dismissively. No. I'm not saying that dismissively or derisively, but I'm saying in a different fashion, which is the wealth effect has created a class of human being, a small class, who are unbelievably wealthy. But you know, it's a function, Tom. You know, you remember, I remember, Pam, in 1976 when I came to Wall Street, the Dow was at 600 going to 400. If you had just put money into the market, it didn't matter what you did, you would accumulate tremendous levels of capital. But you have to be in the game in order to benefit from the game.
Patient and also unemotional.
Staying the course. You make adjustments, of course,
right.
But no pun intended. But nonetheless, you have to be in the game and you have to be unemotional. And frankly, you know, when there's a rollover in the market, bingo, that's the time to be putting money to work.
Where I grew up, it was people that bought Kodak, you know, from Frank Strong and George Eastman, or they bought a company called Haloid, which became a company called Xerox. Mm-hmm. You must have clients who bought Apple for a song or Amazon when they sold books. What do you advise them to do when it becomes 20 and 30 and 40% of a portfolio? How dare you sell that? Do you write puts again? What do you do with a huge gain that overweights a portfolio?
Well, I think writing some calls against it and having some of that stock called against you makes sense. I mean, there comes a point when there's over concentration in a portfolio.
I'm talking about mass. I'm not talking about some cutesy pie academics out of MIT.
Oh,
I'm talking about huge right. over concentration.
Right. If someone is 50 or 80 or 90% of their portfolio in one stock, you have to caution them to diversify because things happen. Right now, it's tricky because I mean, I have a client who owns tens of thousands of stock as a result of being on a board, and the stock has continued to appreciate and appreciate and appreciate and appreciate. It's very well positioned. It's in the life sciences, healthcare sector.
But,
well, it's 15% of this individual's net worth, so it's not excessive. It's a little excessive, quite honestly, but there's enough resources, so it's okay. But I think you know, Tom, my portfolio for my growth investors is 15 stocks. We say we don't rebalance, but we do. When we get to 11 or 12 or 13%, we have to rebalance. It's imprudent not to. So we've owned companies, you know, certain companies.
Yeah, but Pim, this is against, and Fred and I are on the same page on this, full disclosure, folks, against the industry of rebalancing if you get to 3 or 4% of a portfolio. And think of all the gain you lost on Apple or Amazon if you're smart enough to buy them.
Right.
There's
a whole list of stocks. Look at the top 100.
I mean, basic.
50
I mean, is it too much, Fred, to say it's basically on the edge of Sequoia? You and I are talking about a model that really harkens back to the genius of Sequoia.
Absolutely. Listen, I mean, concentration matters. You have to. You can't. If you own the market, you will perform like the market. If you want to outperform the market, you have to be concentrated, which means you have to have a point of view, and you have to have sectors and companies that you know well, that you feel will perform in a superior way. And that's a focus on secular growth, in my experience.
Buy stocks now?
Yes. Although new money coming in, I'm telling my clients, look, if you're the kind of person who's going to have a regret that we buy at this level and it goes down 10% because of it, which I'm not predicting, but if you're going to live with deep regret and you're not going to, you'll get that back within a year or two, there's an alternative. And so certain clients were putting money into 90 and 180 and 270 day and 360 day CDs. And when they mature, we put the money to work. So we're kind of dollar cost averaging.
Yeah.
It's a psychological thing. And yeah. It's not really compelling to me to be doing it because I don't think I don't think we're ready for a recession yet.
This was valuable, but it's not why we booked you. Are the Toronto Maple Leafs just totally loaded this year? Is it going to be like a joy for you to go to Boston, Fleet Center, Boston Garden, whatever, and see the Toronto Maple Leafs?
It's never a joy to go to Fleet because the Bruins just don't have the skilled players that I like to see play.
Oh, really?
I like to see the opposing teams. Boston has always had a tradition, in my view, Bobby Orr being the great exception, of not having flashy, highly skilled, great skating players.
That's
they just
true.
Don't. They just don't.
They don't play ECAC hockey. I mean, cut to the chase, right?
Right.
Fred Lane with us on ECAC hockey and, of course, with Lane Generational with Raymond. You have some interesting insight there, folks.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Right now, Aaron Brown with us with UBS as we look at where to place the money. And the big difference, Aaron, is all of a sudden there's a yield in the short-term space. Are we back to normal equity and bond correlations?
Yeah, I think that we are back to what I think is going to persist for some time, which is a negative stock-bond correlation. I think that's really important for asset managers and particularly for us as an asset allocator in that given the fact that the stock-bond correlation is negative, it helps actually for asset allocators to be long stocks and be long bonds as a diversifier. So you actually can stay longer stocks and have a larger weight of allocation to equities in your portfolio given the fact that the stock bond correlation is negative.
I mean, how 2006? It's been that long, right?
It has. And we think it's going to persist. What could turn it negative is if we were to see inflation spike.
Well, Pim, go ahead.
Well, please. I was going to ask about the earnings boom that you're seeing in U.S. companies, particularly, and where they're going to use the money that they make. Are they going to be paying down more debt? And that means that there's going to be less supply of corporate bonds.
So that's likely right. I think that you are going to see them continuing to pay down debt. But I think that particularly right now, given the fact that rates are still low, that the expectation that rates are going to rise, you are still going to see, I think, pretty lofty bond issuance, which is one of the reasons, actually, that we are negative high yield right now in our asset allocation portfolios to equities.
Aaron Brown with us, and we will continue. Right now, is such a tradition, Pim, is a moment of silence at the New York Stock Exchange. It is more often, but today most poignant, isn't it?
Yes, it is. A moment of silence for the passing of Senator John McCain, former Navy aviator, and also really a maverick on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
And in New York, of course, Senator Schumer talking about renaming the Russell Building in Washington for John McCain. Let us listen into the quiet at the New York Stock Exchange. The New York Stock Exchange, in honor of John McCain. We've seen this many times, Pim, and of course, as we come up on September 11th, I should announce within the remembrance of September 11th that I'll be with Cantor Fitzgerald again this year with Scarlett Fu.
Yes.
In their efforts to remember September 11th.
Let us continue.
Why don't you continue?
Yes,
with Aaron Brown.
Aaron Brown of UBS, Managing Director, Head of Asset Allocation. Is asset allocation something that depends on the perspective of UBS or the perspective of the client?
It's a great question. It actually, we have our own capital market assumptions and our own asset allocation views. There are certain parameters that clients, when we're speaking with clients, will set for us and with us. And so they'll ask us to take a specific overweight to an asset class or to a country, or in many cases to hedge, if we're talking to a sovereign wealth fund, to hedge the underlying currency that they transact in. Also, what we're seeing increasingly is specific clients want to increase their private market asset allocation views. So whether it's into real estate, into hedge funds, into venture capital, or into real assets like real estate, timber, other commodities. So a lot of times, certainly we will have our own views and we have our own capital market assumptions that underpin how we allocate. But a lot of the dialogue that we have with clients is understanding what their parameters are and what they either want to include or exclude in terms of asset allocation.
Well, the reason I ask this, and I'm glad you mentioned these situations, is because risk is a two-edged sword, right?
Absolutely.
Least a two-edged sword, maybe a nine-edged sword. But the reason being that risk is great when you're making money. But do they really understand the risks that they're taking by asking to go into these private investments that may lack liquidity?
It's interesting because if you rewind a couple of years ago in terms of the asset allocation conversations that we were having, they were looking to mitigate risk. They were looking to lower their equity allocations. Now that we're, you know, several years in, 10 years into the bull market, equity assets have outperformed, you know, certainly what their expectations are. We're now actually seeing the opposite conversations having, and clients wanting to increase risk, willing to take more risk on, potentially more illiquidity risk as well, in order to earn a higher return. And so the question, I think, is prudent, which is this the right point in the cycle to be doing that? Mm-hmm. And I think given how well private market assets have performed, there is a willingness to be able to take that illiquidity risk. The one thing I will say is there are, from our asset allocation studies, there are benefits to diversification, to expanding the asset classes and the remit in which you're investing in. You know, the question
can
is,
can you be too diversified?
I'm sorry, say it again?
Can you be too diversified?
Absolutely, you can be too diversified.
It's a huge risk, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
It's been one of our themes for the show today. I mean, not that you want to own only Apple or only Amazon and look like a genius, but you know, as Peter Lynch called it, diversification is a tangible issue.
Yeah, and that's why I think you really have to be critical in terms of the interplay between tactical asset allocation, which we define as inside of 12 months, and longer-term asset allocation, which we define as 12 months plus.
How do you respond to clients, very quickly here, how do you respond to clients that diversified out and were underinvested in equities and they're angry?
I mean, so a lot of the studies we're doing now are for those types of clients. And we think that it's right now in the cycle, you should still be long and be overweight equities. And we don't think that it's too late to be overweight equities at this point. But we understand that over the next 3 years, we're predicting that we will have a recession. So you have to be really manage that tactical risk as well.
Aaron Brown, thank you so much with UBS today on the battle of asset allocation. This has been great, Pim, to have Fred Lane with us and then Aaron Brown. Really, you know, it's like that time of year.
Yes. And also just to, you know, be a little patient and don't get emotional.
Well, easier said than done, particularly with as we talked to James Trevidas earlier about the Navy and John McCain, it is appropriate to talk to the 22nd Attorney General of Arizona about John McCain in Arizona. And this is Grant Woods, who is the rarest of rare in American politics, someone within the middle territory of his Republican Party. Grant Woods, wonderful to have you with us. And particularly, I would suggest, out of New York and Washington, the focus is on John McCain of the East, of Annapolis, and of the Naval Academy, where he'll be buried. How divisive was John McCain within Arizona Republican politics?
Well, that's a good question, and thank you for all you're doing here to honor Senator McCain and talk about his amazing life. Well, I think as time went on, there's a big difference, as I think we see around the country, between the hardcore activists in the Republican Party, and they were generally not very supportive of Senator McCain, and haven't been for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then you had the general population there, that, you know, just Republicans throughout Arizona, and obviously he was very popular there. He won handily every time that he ran. So, you know, when you go to the Republican meetings with the hardcore, it wasn't pretty. You know, when he ran for president in 08, and they did their little election at the state Republican meeting, and they endorsed Duncan Hunter for president, not John McCain. And that didn't work out too well for them, I don't think. But it was typical. But, you know, it's just the way it goes. It was they were pretty hardcore, and they didn't like the fact that he regularly worked with people across party lines. Mm-hmm.
Grant, can you explain what seemed to be the personal enmity between President Donald Trump and Senator McCain? Why did that exist?
I don't think, I think it's a one-way street, to be honest with you. I think Senator McCain, you know, he's, as everyone knows now and has reflected upon, he had quite the remarkable life, and he had been up against different powerful forces his entire life. So here in his latter years, when Donald Trump entered the picture, that was no big deal for John McCain. John McCain was going to be John McCain, and that means he was going to say what he thought and do what he thought was right for the country. And he didn't really engage in any of this personal enmity. On the other hand, it really did seem to get under Donald Trump's skin. And I think that's just because it's reflective of the men. President Trump's been very, very good at ridiculing people to the point where they ultimately back down and go away or get on board. And that just wasn't going to happen with John. But I can tell you, over the last couple of years, so since Trump announced until now, it really wasn't personal. It didn't really bother him, these insults or slights or all of that. The only one that bothered John was when he said that John wasn't a hero because he was captured. And I promise you, it was not because of him taking a personal insult at that, their last, but it was about the other POWs and the fact that here in their later years, they had to deal with this issue. That's not in. And he really resented that, I will say.
Yeah. Grant Wood's one of the most poignant images we've seen as we speak of John McCain was him going up an airplane stairs with Rob Portman of Ohio. I would suggest you and Senator Portman represent the dinosaurs of the Republican Party, the dying breed, maybe with Olympia Snow of Maine, of some form of monetarism. How risky is your Republican Party of doing a Whig, if you will, of wandering into the trap of the Whigs of 1850, 1852, and on to the death of 1856? Is that a legitimate risk out in Arizona?
I think so, for sure. And I think it will happen here in Arizona, and I think it will happen across the United States if things don't change. And as Senator McCain always said, if for no other reasons, he'd like for you to do things for the right reason, but if for no other reasons, look at the demographics. And if the Republican Party is going to be anti-Hispanic, anti-minorities, if it's going to be if it really isn't going to stand up for the Constitution and just be divisive between groups, then there really is no future there. And if you talk to people who are under the age of, I don't know, let's say 35, they don't understand why the Republican Party acts that way. They don't see race necessarily as even an issue. They don't see discrimination against people because of their sexual orientation as as an issue. Why are you people still talking about these things? And I think as we go forward, Republicans are going to have to remember what they're all about, which is limited government, which is strong national defense, and working with our allies. And most importantly, from John McCain's perspective, we have to stand for what he stood for, and that is for basic human rights
right.
in the United States, around the world. And if we don't stand for that, if it's just a party about me, which is the opposite of John McCain, then it probably deserves to go away.
Tim?
Well, I just want to reintroduce, we're speaking with Grant Woods, former Attorney General of the state of Arizona and a former Chief of Staff for Senator John McCain when he was in Congress as a congressman. Grant, just tell, if you can, a little. There's a story that maybe not a lot of people know having to do with how Senator John McCain requested a combat assignment in the Vietnam War, and he was 30 years old. When he was assigned to the USS Forrestal, and he escaped death on the Forrestal during a horrendous fire.
Yes. That's where he wanted to be, where the action was. He was quite the character, always. And in those days, he was kind of like your Tom Cruise stereotypical fighter pilot, you know, live hard, play hard. And he wanted to be in combat. And then when he was on the Forrestal, he was on the deck that day. And that was just one of the big tragedies of all time in our military. And I know John told me, there was a guy, I forget what his nickname was, but there was a guy who would wash your window of your jet just before you were getting ready to take off. So they were all lined up, and this guy always gave him a thumbs up, and he said something, some little phrase. And so there's John in there in the cockpit. The guy does that, and then all of a sudden there's this huge explosion with one of these bombs that gone off. And he looked down. There was a fire and then another big explosion. And when he looked down, that guy who he knew very well, who was his friend, was gone. He had evaporated into the air, and somehow John got out of that plane before the next huge explosion and made his way across the deck, whereas, you know, many, many people didn't.
Yeah.
And I think the remarkable thing there, which doesn't surprise anyone, is that almost immediately he asked to go to another ship so he could get back in the air and fighting for our country.
Well, Grant Woods, thank you so much. On short notice, greatly, greatly appreciate your attendance today, Mr. Woods, a close, close friend and advisor to John McCain in Arizona. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.